This committee to order. Welcome, everybody. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Senator Bishop, Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairman Rivak. At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, please silence your cell phones. Welcome to the first hearing of the Senate Resources Committee of the 32nd Legislature. I'd like to take a moment to express how very honored that I am that my colleagues have selected me to chair this committee. I look forward to exploring the programs and activities of the Department of Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and Environmental Conservation. While Alaska has challenges to address in light of the new federal administrative orders, I look forward to exploring solutions and working collaboratively with all of you to find pathways to better success, better access, responsible management, and development of our state resources to the benefit of all Alaskans. I'd like to give my committee members an opportunity to introduce themselves and their committee staff if they'd like to. I'd also like to note that we've been joined by Vice Chair Senator Machicki. And maybe we could just start with Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jesse Keel, and you're sitting in my district, so I am pleased and proud to have the legislature back in Alaska's capital. I am joined this year by Edric Carrillo for the third year in a row, staffing our work on the Resources Committee in my office.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Bishop.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations and to all my colleagues that are back here this year. I'd like to recognize my committee staff, Cody Grusendorf, back there in the room. He comes from good stock and very, very intelligent young man.
Great. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thrilled to be here. It's a great team. And look forward to the many issues that we're going to be facing. We know that hundreds of Alaskans were sent home from work in the last week, many of them in my district. There's a middle ground that can be a right answer even when there's a Democrat administration. And I hope we find that balance, because what we're looking at right now is scary for the people of Alaska. I'm looking forward to working on those issues with you. I know we have fish issues, and we have mining and oil and gas and land use issues, fish and game. So looking forward to working with you and the team, and hope to do great things. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleasure to be on the committee and to be working with you on this. I'm Senator Gary Stevens. My staff will be Tim Lamkin, who spends his time between Fairbanks and Juneau here. My major interest will be in everything we're dealing with, but also particularly in fisheries and fisheries issues. And as you know, it's such an important part of our economy, but we're entering a pretty terrible time here with in the pollock fishery, one of the greatest fisheries in the world, biggest producer a great producer of protein, and they are having difficulties. The biggest plant in Alaska at Accutan has been closed because of COVID, and two or three others are facing that as well. So a tough time for the industry, and I'm looking forward to seeing how we can help.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Kawasaki, representing the Interior City of Fairbanks, and I just wanted to welcome my staff. I've got Robin O'Donohue. He served as an intern many years ago, maybe just a year ago, and then became immediately staff working on resource issues. With him is my other intern, Max Robichaud. He's from Anchorage, but he does work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's also going to be working on resource issues and staffing the office. So great to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, and I would like to introduce up front at the computer station, my committee staff, Betty Tangeman. This is her fifth year with the legislature, and she served as my committee aide last year for the State Affairs Committee. I want to thank you for the wonderful job that you've done and that I'm sure you will do. Also present in the room is Dirk Kraft, my chief of staff, who's been with the legislature since 2006. Online is our Senate Record Secretary, Chris Dirkwell, or Dirkrell, forgive me. And last but not least, we have present in the room, Nate Williams, is our LIO moderator, who did a fantastic job for us last year. So thank you to all the staff. We all appreciate you very much and all the work that you do. The purpose of today's meeting is to obtain an overview from the Department of Natural Resources and hear about any areas of concern. We'll get started with invited testimony, and on the line we have DNR Commissioner Corey Feige, as well as Justin Black, Deputy Director for the Division of Oil and Gas, who will be starting us off with the presentation that you all should have in your binders. We also have on the line Kevin Frank, who is the Resource Evaluation Manager for the Department of National Resources, who will be available for any questions the committee may have. For today's presentation, I think it'll be best to allow committee members to ask questions after each slide. So those listening, please give us a chance to ask questions after each slide. These presentations will be given telephonically, so there can be some difficulty in breaking through. So if you do that, we'd greatly appreciate it. Before we start, do we have any questions of committee members? All right, with that, then I will hand it over to Commissioner Feige. Commissioner Feige, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Corey Feige, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. It is very much a pleasure for myself and Justin Black to be with you all today to discuss, for today's presentation, North Slope Oil and Gas and the recent federal actions that have been taken. We will fill the time, I assure you, allotted to us today. This is a very fluid situation. More importantly, before we get going into the meat of the presentation, however, I would like to say that it is good to see all of you back in Juneau and to know that you're all safe and healthy. It goes without saying that we are leaving behind us in 2020 a year of unprecedented volatility in oil markets and production levels across the globe. As you all know, this has been driven by pandemic-related price collapse, pro-rationing of North Slope throughput in the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, and production curtailments due to very low price environments. But we now find ourselves in early 2021 in a period of modest recovery and a bit of stability that shows that we're now holding North Slope production at just under 500,000 barrels per day, with our prices stable in the mid-$50 range. And Betty, if you would go to the next slide, please. On this slide, we've charted out for you the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic for the last 12 months, January 2020, this one through November of 2020. You can see that volatility in both price and production that I spoke of. You can see in April of 2020, we hit a low price at $16.50 per barrel on ANS crude. What's interesting to note is that prices dropped nearly 75% between January 2020 down to that bottom marker price of $16.50 in just 6 months. Pretty scary. Companies immediately launched into curtailments of production, and Trans-Alaska Pipeline prorated throughput in order to compensate for lack of storage capacity at the Valdez Marine Terminal. We saw 60,000 barrels a day come out of the Kuparuk River unit production in June. We saw 40,000 barrels a day curtailed from the Colville River unit production in June. We've seen the Badami unit shut in 1,500 barrels a day in May, only to come back online in October. Thankfully, both Colville River unit and Kuparuk River unit were able to restore full production in July. But we still have throughput in Cook Inlet, not into the taps, but into the local refinery market that has not come back online. And that totals about 1,900 barrels a day between the West MacArthur River unit and the readout unit, which had reached their economic limit with the COVID pandemic conditions. the laydown of the infill drilling programs that we've experienced as a result of COVID-19. You can see the curtailment of production in this chart in June that I talked about, the rebound then in July. But the curtailment of the infill drilling that we've experienced in the past year is going to make itself known in production for the next couple of years to come, because the infill wells that we drill today impact production in the near-term years. All right, and I'll pause at this point for any questions on this slide.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for members of the committee?
All right, Betty, next slide. So looking at what companies have done to actually manage the COVID-19 impacts, we saw, as I mentioned, those rig laydowns across the North Slope. We saw Blue Crest and Cook Inlet curtail their natural gas exploration project postpone that into 2022. We saw drawbacks in those production rates related to the pro-rationing in TAPS that I mentioned before. And all of these, in very real terms, saw Alaska's oil and gas industry and our operations go from full capacity of production and exploration being cut back to bare bones, absolute minimum essential personnel only, in the course of about 10 days. That's an incredible shock on the system. And it is pretty amazing that we find ourselves where we do today with this period of stability. DNR and the Division of Oil and Gas took some very specific steps to help stabilize the industry over the course of the last year. And that included doing things like adding 30 days to the lease award schedule for the fall 19 North Slope lease sale and the spring 20 Cook Inlet lease sale. That allowed the companies and the lessees to better manage their cash flows and allowed the state to continue to capture acreage under lease and not see those acres go unleased and put off into the future. We also granted extension requests on lease rental payments, and we extended deadlines for submitting things like plans of development, data, and other paperwork, simply because we had distributed workforce and we had folks who had a very difficult time just staying up at the pace of business when COVID was really bearing down upon us. Even after a shock of this magnitude, I do want to point out that Alaska's operations continued without any environmental, operational, or significant safety upset. And our companies have managed to keep their workforces healthier than was originally thought possible. All right. Questions on this slide?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed, Commissioner, that these first two slides are called Managing COVID-19 Impacts, and we see the results, the changes that have occurred. Are you laying all these changes to COVID? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, everything. I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator. Yes, everything that you're seeing here was a direct result of the COVID-19 impacts on the workforce and on the industry.
Follow?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think we're missing a piece here. I'd like to know what that impact was and what happened. And, as I say, the first two slides are COVID impacts. I guess we all know that there's been a change, but we don't know the specifics of why it all occurred. So, again, going back to putting it all on COVID, I suppose it makes sense, but I'd like more information on what exactly happened. I mean, what happened to the jobs and all of that. It seems like we're missing something here, Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, can I ask that my liaison work with your staff so that I'm very clear on what it is you'd like to have quantified? We have some statistics on here in terms of barrels that were removed, throughput that was removed, and the implications. I don't have on the slides before me those specific jobs numbers that you referenced, but I'm very happy to reach out to Department of Labor and pull some of those statistics together.
Thank you, Commissioner Feige, and Senator Machicki would very much like to interject here as well.
Yeah, Commissioner, the piece that's missing is the demand decline. I think that's what Senator Stevens is probably asking you. Why were we backed up on the slope? Why was production cut? So can you talk about that demand decline that backed us up through the entire supply chain that caused? So it wasn't the disease. It was the reduction in activity in the lower 48. Can you cover that a little bit?
Yes, through the chair, and thank you for that, Senator. Thank you for the clarification. You're absolutely right. Globally, we saw at the peak of the COVID pandemic response, roughly 20 million barrels a day of global demand taken out of the market. That's equivalent to the entire United States daily production removed from global demand at the peak of the pandemic. And so the roll-up from that, or the upstream impact of that, was that all of the storage on the West Coast filled up. That's where ANS crude goes to. We had storage in the Gulf Coast states that was likewise full. And when you have no place for your oil to go, you have to prorate that or curtail it, if you will, all the way back to the wellhead. And you literally begin to store in the reservoir, for lack of a better term. There were discussions that were facilitated actually by Senator Sullivan at the time with the Department of Energy about opening up strategic empty reservoir space in petroleum reserves around the country to be used as storage so that we could stabilize prices within the U.S. Thankfully, we never got to that point, but I think that we'll see that discussion live on in the years to come in terms of trying to stabilize that overall industry picture. And so by the time we began to bounce back, I believe today we've brought about 50%, maybe a little more than that, in terms of global demand back online. As we look toward variants of the disease that we're beginning to see manifest in places like China and Africa, there will again, I believe, be some wobbles in some of that demand. And so the system itself is still rather brittle, but to take a hit of 20 million barrels a day out of global demand, that is that massive shock to the system that precipitated the changes that you see presented on these graphs.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Feige. Other questions? All right, please proceed.
All right, fantastic, thank you. And slide 4, please, Betty. So North Slope production, as the members of this committee likely know, accounts for about 98% of all oil production in Alaska. And between, even with the COVID response and that global decline in demand, I believe that 2020 will stand as a testament to the durability of Alaska's operations, because between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 20, we only averaged a 1% decline in production. And the optimizations that were put into place during those years were in part what allowed us to rebound to a period of stability much more rapidly than I believe we otherwise would have. Some of the major changes that have occurred in Alaska's North Slope production profile include the transfer of all of BP's assets in June of 2020 to the new owner, Hilcorp. Hilcorp immediately at Prudhoe Bay Unit, as the new operator, began to deploy some strong production optimization and cost-cutting efforts. That certainly helped as prices began to decline. Conoco did a fantastic job with cost control and cash flow management with their curtailments at Kuparuk and Colville River, allowing those two units to come back on to full production at the end of those curtailments in July. Hilcorp's Milne Point unit actually grew production by 28% between fiscal year 19 and 20, and in just the year prior to that had grown production by an additional 14%. So a pretty spectacular level of investment and optimization going on at Milne Point that's really contributed to stability and increased production in that field. The Point Thompson unit, similarly operated by Exxon, has progressively improved their facility reliability through new investment in new compressor designs and new approach to how they manage the extremely high pressure at the Point Thompson field, and that's allowed them to stabilize production at some of the highest levels we've seen since that field came online in 2016. We've got some exciting near-term projects over the course of the next couple of years that will bring additional production into the TAPS. We have expansion drilling at GMT2 at within the NPRA, and we'll certainly be watching that for any potential impacts from the incoming administration's policies. We will see CD5 expansion and the Fjord West development in the Colville River Unit. Colville River Unit is state land and ASRC jointly managed land. And then Milne Point has their Raven Pad development slated for, or excuse me, Hillcorp does, for the Milne Point unit. And then projects farther out, obviously we have PICA, which is Oil Search and Repsol. They're aiming to enter their feed phase by the end of 2021. And then Willow, also within the NPRA, Conoco is moving that project toward feed and a final investment decision by the end of calendar 2021. And that's another one that we'll be watching very closely for any potential impacts due to the incoming policies. Any questions on this slide?
Questions? I have a question. Of the near future projects coming in, you mentioned some of the orders, the presidential and secretarial orders. We've all seen 3395. How do you feel that this might threaten any of these, and is the department prepared to deal with that, and in what ways?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we are watching both GMT2 and the Willow development very, very closely. From discussions that we've had with industry, they have the permits that they need in hand presently. They're actually drilling at GMT2, and that's an established development. And then Willow has the permits that they need for construction operation and development of material sites this winter. Now, where we're likely to see impacts from the Biden administration's policies will be in the how the companies can secure any future permits. There could potentially be delays. There could potentially be, I guess, a slow rolling, if you will, of the process. And then certainly there's litigation currently active around Willow, which could be brought to bear on the record of decision associated with their work plan. The state is watching all of those very closely. We have intervened in litigation to ensure that we have a seat at the table and a voice. Ultimately, these are developments on federal lands, and the state takes a bit of a support role, if you will, in seeing these developments come to pass. But we will leverage everything that we have at our disposal to ensure that the state's interests are protected and that these projects can continue to move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Feige. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, my question, I find it interesting that even with some of the price challenges and such that we've seen in the last 4 years, that we have reduced our decline from close to 6% for quite some time, and then it came down a little lower than 6% for a decline somewhere in the 3.5%, 4%. What would you attribute the 1% decline in? And is that something that you think we could turn around with some better economics on PICA and Willow?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you for that question. That 1% decline is driven almost entirely by optimization campaigns in the facilities and in the production operations within our operating units on the North Slope. The step up in infill drilling campaigns that we saw up until the curtailment due to COVID last year was moving along at a lovely clip. We anticipate that will rebound, especially with stable prices. We're also encouraged by the fact that the new seismic data that was acquired over the Prudhoe unit just before BP made the sale to Hilcorp is generating some exciting targets for new oil accumulations that Hilcorp is feeling very bullish about being able to go after. And then certainly by the time we start bringing in new production in the mid-2020s from things like Pikka and things like Willow, provided they stay on schedule and aren't impacted dramatically by the Biden administration, then that would certainly help to offset decline. Our mature fields on the slope, Kuparik, Colville River, Prudhoe certainly, have an average decline rate of between 4 and 6%. So 5% is a good number. That is the natural decline rate of mature fields of this type. So any new production that comes online will be coming on to offset that. I do believe that we'll see a shift toward the importance of state lands and exploration and development on state lands over the course of the next 4 years, and I believe that that means very good things for the discovery rate. You know, we've seen since about 2013, 2014, a pretty steady discovery rate of over 90% on the central north slope that's related to the Nanushuk and the Torok plays, in particular what we call the Brookian play type, which is the Nanushuk, which is being developed at Pikka. And, excuse me, I think we'll see a growing focus on that over the course of the next 4 years as there are some uncertainties to be found on federal acreage.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Marchicki.
Commissioner, you're being careful on probably the primary reason why we're seeing additional investment. Do you think this would have occurred had the tax structure been dramatically different? So would those same choices have occurred in investment and optimization, additional exploration, and all the activity we've seen in NPRA?
Through the chair, Senator Marchicki, I do not believe that the investment would have been the same had we seen a change in tax structure. We were being told directly by industry that they were making investment decisions because dollars that are invested in Alaska are in competition with dollars that are spent in other basins and other places around the world. So, you know, every policy matters in this market and in this kind of a climate. And I think it's also important to note that the current climate that we find ourselves in, with the curtailment of shale and even the instability in federal acreage across the West and the lower 48, actually sets the stage for a bit of opportunity for Alaska, because those investment dollars will look for a place to go. And we've seen a rebalancing of the portfolios in investment houses and in companies in the oil sector who are looking for less high decline shale resources and shale assets, and putting a greater focus now back to longer duration, more stable, high level production out of conventional assets. And I think that if we do our job right at getting the word out about Alaska being open for business, and that we are a stable environment in which to operate, and that we have durable, predictable permitting processes, et cetera, we stand to capture a fair bit of that that otherwise capital looking for a home, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Marchicki. Any other questions? Well, at this time, I'd like to take a brief pause to welcome Senator Von Imhoff, and just give you the cliff notes quick. We're all real happy to be here. I'm very, very honored to chair the committee, and if you'd like to introduce your staff very quick, we all.
Thank you. I'm Natasha Von Imhoff, and I have staff Shireen Crosby.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all that you do, Shireen. All right. Commissioner Feige, please continue.
Great. Thank you very much. And, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I'm going to hand the mic over, so to speak, to Justin Black, who is the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, to talk about the lease sale results and give an activity update for the North Slope. Justin?
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, my name is Justin Black. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the Department of Natural Resources. And on slide 5, you will see an overview map with some figures of our most recent lease sale conducted in just 2 weeks ago, January 13th. We opened the bids. It was a promising lease sale in terms of results, a little over $7 million for the state and leasing 115 tracks. We had five different companies that are apparent high bidders, some which we are familiar with, and one of them is a new entrant into Alaska in Arctic Circle Exploration LLC. It picked up a conglomeration of leases south of Prudhoe Bay. Great Bear Petroleum Ventures acquired some offset lease acreage to their recently formed Talitha unit, so that's encouraging to see. They want to expand their holdings around their current footprint. Hillcorp North Slope, which is the entity that operates Prudhoe Bay for Hillcorp, acquired three tracks to the north of the unit, adjacent to the unit. Lanyap Alaska acquired additional acreage south of the Badami unit alongside some of existing lease holdings that they have. And finally, Oil Search Alaska acquired some infill acreage and some offset acreage down near their holdings to the west. We held the lease sale in January of this year, in part because of the COVID-19 impacts. As Commissioner Feige mentioned earlier, with some of the deferrals that we gave the industry in making payments, we wanted to allow some additional time for those rentals to be paid or leases to be surrendered so that they could be included in this upcoming lease sale, and that proved to be fairly successful. So if there's any questions on this slide, I will pause.
Questions? Oh, please continue.
Great. Betty, if you can go to slide 6, please. Here we have our North Slope oil and gas activity map, and it's quite busy, but a few things I want to highlight. First, I'll highlight on activity occurring this winter. If you look in the center of the slide, there is the Talitha unit, which is just offsetting of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. The Talitha unit is operated by Great Bear Pantheon, and they have already spud the Talitha A well this winter. This unit was approved last fall, and they quickly got financing in order to drill this well this winter. So we're anticipating and hoping for strong results from Great Bear Pantheon. We also have the Alcade unit that Great Bear had approved this past fall, which is adjacent to the Talitha unit. They had drilled a well there a few years ago, so more exploration activities and development activities will be occurring there over the next couple of years. Down to the west in the NPRA, we have a box there pointing for Accumulate Energy, and 88 Energy is an affiliate where we have the Merlin and Harrier wells. The Merlin well is anticipated to receive a permit shortly from the federal government, and there's also hope for an additional well in the Harrier well this winter. Going north in the Milne Point unit, I want to highlight just the level of activity that Hillcorp has in the Milne Point unit. They've got up to 17 wells and 20 workover wells for this current POD period, which is phenomenal work, as Corey mentioned, the 14% and 28% increase in production over the last few years. So a lot of great work being done by Hillcorp. Now to some not so near term, but still on the horizon activity. If you look all the way in the top left of the slide, there is the West Harrison Bay unit operated by Shell. This was a unit that the Division of Oil and Gas approved this past fall, and we're very excited to have these discussions with Shell and view their plans for this unit. So in the next several years, we should be seeing a well being planned out in the West Harrison Bay unit. And then moving just to the right, we have Oil Search and Repsol. They're going to a phased development approach there in the PICA unit, and lots of activity going on there in terms of building their infrastructure. And over the next few years, hope to see a lot of development drilling in the PICA unit. Going over to the right, you'll see in the Badami unit over towards Point Thompson, that's where Savant operates the Badami unit. Just very thankful that the production was able to be restored in October of 2020 after a few months being shut in. Of course, Corey's already highlighted the benefits of Hilcorp taking over operatorship at Prudhoe Bay there in the center. And, yeah, we're very pleased to see the level of activity in within the Division of Oil and Gas. Some might think with all the curtailments that perhaps it was a slow year for the Division of Oil and Gas, but we've seen a tremendous amount of activity. We are partnering with industry, but we have that regulatory hat for the benefit of all Alaskans. We want to see the development, but done in a responsible way. So, lots of promising things to come this winter and over the next several years. So I'll pause for questions.
Great. Thanks, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Black, just for clarification, when you're making reference to PODs, I'm assuming you're talking about plans of development?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, that is a plan of development.
Thank you.
I have a question. You mentioned in the NPRA that you expect permits to come soon. Could you elaborate on that as it relates to some of the orders that we've seen? You don't see you don't see any of these permits being in jeopardy?
Yes, Chairman, 88 Energy released a press release just a couple of days ago where they anticipated that they will get the permit that they need for the Merlin well, anticipated by tomorrow. It's still unsure, but that's what they indicated in their press release. They had a pause on their trading on the Australian Exchange, and with that press release, we're able to resume trading.
Thank you. Questions? Please continue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back on the record, this is Corey Feige. The next slide, slide seven, before we talk about the revenue generated by North Slope Oil and Gas and give you just a quick summary of what the last few years have looked like, I wanted to remind the members of the committee of the varying royalty rates across state lands and federal lands on the North Slope. If we start in the middle with state lands, you note that the state royalty rates are either 12.5 or 16 2/3, and the state's royalty share is either 83% if we're talking about the jointly managed lands with ASRC in the Colville River unit and a portion of PICA, or it's 100% of the royalty take on just straight non-state lands. If we move to the offshore, from 0 to 3 miles out, that is state submerged lands and state waters, and the state receives 100% of the royalty, and the rate is 16 2/3. When we go to 3 to 6 miles, the state receives 27% in a split with the federal government, and then beyond 6 miles, we receive nothing. It's federal water. If we go to the west into NPRA, the royalty rate is either 12.5% or 16 2/3. And here, while the state has a 50% royalty split that includes rents and bonus payments, in addition to royalty, those revenues do not come directly to either the permanent fund or the general fund. Those funds go into what is called the Impact Mitigation Grant Fund, which was established many years ago to help revenue generated from oil development in the NPRA offset impacts to North Slope communities. If we then move to the far eastern part of this map, in the 1002 area of the Anwar Coastal Plain, the state of Alaska will receive 50% of the royalties, rents, and bonuses from the leases that were let on January 6th in that sale, and the royalty rate for those leases is 16 2/3. So questions on this slide, or we'll advance?
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. I was curious if we've thought about reviving the effort for a better mix on the submerged lands beyond 3 miles, similar to what happened in the Gulf a few years back. Is that is there any potential for new interest in that type of agreement for Alaska?
Sorry, yes, apologize, had the mute problem. Senator Machicki, through the chair, yes, there is certainly interest in changing that split rate. We have engaged with, and I know that the congressional delegation has also looked into that in association with the OCS leasing program. That conversation obviously will depend upon and turn upon how the Biden administration chooses to approach offshore leasing.
No, just as a follow-up, if I could, yes. Mr. Chairman, I suppose if they're going to compromise our ability to develop due to some of their new policies, perhaps they'll see somewhat of an exchange for what's already under production. I don't know. I mean, I hope neither. Well, I hope the policies I just talked about don't continue, but if they do, I think we need to try to expand our rights on submerged lands and OCS lands. That's would be a minimum expectation considering the impacts to a state that Alaska will have the worst results from those new policies than any other state.
Yes, and through the chair, Senator Machicki, I agree with you. And perhaps that becomes a bargaining chip at some point for something like a Liberty development once we have a clearer picture of the legal situation with that development.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
All right. And moving on then to slide 8. This shows you the petroleum revenue from North Slope based for the fiscal year 2020. And this slide shows you both restricted and unrestricted fund sources. In the unrestricted fund sources, we have royalty and taxes. And on the tax side, that's broken down from or with production tax, as well as petroleum property tax. And you can see that in fiscal 2020, those unrestricted revenues brought in just over $1 billion. On the restricted fund side, which includes those revenues that go to the Alaska Permanent Fund, the split that goes to the Public School Trust Fund, and the those monies that come in from any tax or royalty settlements and go directly to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, as well as funds that come into the Impact Mitigation Grant Fund for NPRA, those totaled about $620 million for a year-on total of $1.7 billion. And no questions? Next slide.
Yes, we have a question. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I see the tax and royalty settlements to the Budget Reserve Fund are significantly higher than they've been in several years. Can you fill us in a little bit? What is something? Are we starting to settle new types of cases? Is that something that's been lingering for a while? What's how do we explain that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you for that question. I'm glad you highlighted that. The Department of Natural Resources has been working very, very diligently for the last 18 months or so at settling what are long-standing appeals and disputes around the, in particular, audits and the would be the royalty audits. And then I know that the Department of Revenue likewise has been very focused on settling long-standing appeals related to tax settlements. And so what you see reflected here is due, I believe, in large part to the cleanup, if you will, that was done and the work that was done around taking care of and resolving with BP all of their outstanding tax and royalty disputes prior to their exit from the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please continue.
All right. Then on the next slide, this slide shows the petroleum revenue, again, those same both restricted and unrestricted types of funding, but just by year. And what we wanted to do with this slide was to give you a bit of a look back to fiscal 17, so roughly a five-year window, and then give you a forecast of, from the revenue sources book, what we believed that fiscal 21 and fiscal 22 may look like. Now, a couple of things that I note in this slide right away is that in fiscal 21 and 22 forecast, we have an ANS price in the mid-40s. Where we sit today, we're a bit ahead of that. So it could be that we have a bit of an upside in fiscal 21. We'll have to see how the price performance goes for the rest of the year. But that is one thing to highlight. And then you'll notice some fairly flat or slightly increased barrel per day production rates on the slope. And where we sit today, we're actually just below 500,000 barrel per day. So these came from production forecast, where what we can see today are the actual production numbers. So from a price and a production standpoint, we are slightly ahead of where we thought we would be in the forecast.
Questions? Thank you. Please continue.
Very good. So moving on to slide 13, we'll now take a close look at federal leases in on the North Slope. So what we're zooming in on here first is the NPRA. And you can see everything that's in tan on the left side of that slide. That represents the roughly, it's a little over 2.6 million acres in 307 tracts that are currently under lease in the NPRA. In total, there's about 23 million acres in NPRA. Large portions have been set aside for environmental and wildlife protection, the area around Teshkapuk Lake and a large area north of the Colville River in the southwest portion, which you can't see on this map. It's off the left side. But the lease acreage in the sand color there is held the farthest to the west is a company called North Slope Exploration, and that is an affiliate of Armstrong Oil and Gas. We also have a small company called Borealis Oil, which has a few leases sort of in the middle portion of that horseshoe. And then we have Conoco, which has a very commanding leasehold position on the eastern side of those leases. And you can see the Greater Moose's Tooth unit development, and then you can see the Bear Tooth unit development. Willow resides inside the Bear Tooth unit development, and then West Willow sits just outside to the west of the unit boundary. You also see the Project Peregrine, it's called 88 Energy and Emerald House that Justin spoke of a little bit ago. Just to add a bit of additional information there, we do know that the congressional delegation was working closely with White House staff over the weekend to explain impacts to that program. They had been given their authorizations to proceed and travel across federal lands for purposes of mobilizing that program, and were just quite simply waiting on the final paper to catch up with them. And that's standard operating procedure for getting out and on the ground. When the secretarial order came up on the 20th and imposed the 60-day delay, that created a pause, obviously, for 88 Energy. And, you know, we're talking about in what I read in the press and what was publicly available is, you know, they've expended about $3 million already on that program in terms of executing the rig contract and commencing snow road and pad production for accessing. I've done a lot of work myself out in that particular area, and it's over 100 miles of snow road that has to be constructed from the Dalton Highway just to access that acreage. So it's something that takes a fair bit of lead time in the way of mobilization. So we are looking eagerly for them to notify us that they have received those final signed authorizations. Taking 60 days out of a program on Alaska's North Slope is equivalent to taking a year, because we do not have the length of season here to absorb 60 days like you may in places in the lower 48. So again, to Senator Michicki's earlier point, we are disproportionately impacted by decisions like this that come down. So we will be watching very closely. Again, earlier in the presentation, we noted that the drilling at Greater Moose's Tooth, they have permits in hand and authorizations in hand for that work. And similarly for the program for the initial phase of construction at Willow. And we will continue to watch that very closely along with Peregrine. Now, Oil Search also holds a few tracts just inside the NPRA boundary, and it's where the Colville River comes around and hooks kind of up to the north and then goes straight south. That's in the area of Oil Search's new, what do they call it, horseshoe discovery. And last year, I believe it was, they drilled a confirmation well at Stirrup. So they hold some acreage in that area as well. All right, questions?
Yes, thank you. We do have a couple questions. Before we get there, I'd like to note that Senator Holland has joined us in the room, and we'll start out with questions from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Commissioner, I really appreciate the slide, and so I just want to confirm, just so I fully understand, so the light tan horseshoe area in NPRA is already leased. Some are active, some are not, but in pertaining to the Biden administration, based on what you're hearing, land that's already leased can't be unleased or taken away or stopped or stymied or whatever, just new leases. I guess I'm just trying to make sure that what the tan area that we have here can, when it's economically viable, can move forward, and there should not be any political roadblocks from this new presidential administration. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, you are correct. That is all leased acreage. It is a valid pre-existing property right and cannot just be summarily done away with. Where there will be delays on exploration will be that any exploration work that's going to be undertaken on that acreage is subject to receipt of federal permits. And so that is where the state is going to have to work very closely with our federal partners in supporting entities that wish to get out and explore that acreage.
Thank you. I follow you now. It's the 60-day ice road or snow road that you were discussing. So there are ways to stymie it in terms of the permitting angle.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, that's correct. And one of the things that we saw under, for example, the Obama administration is just permits took a little longer. Sometimes authorizations didn't get done as quickly, or they may have been sent back to D.C. for review as opposed to just being handled in the local office. So I would anticipate that the tempo of exploration will certainly be impacted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Feige, along the same lines, dovetailing with Senator Von Imhoff, you know, we've got a change in administrations. You got people that capitalized X number of dollars to do this ice road, to secure this rig. Then you got a new administration with a 60-day full stop. Is there any recourse that could be made whole? Because these people are out cash, and no fault of their own. It's a new administration, I'm hoping that you and our delegation might be looking at those avenues to help these people out.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes. As I mentioned before, if you hold a lease, you have a valid pre-existing property right. And while policy can be set with the stroke of a pen, the law is still the law, and you are still due certain rights. And if you are harmed through the arbitrary actions of an agency, there is remedy and recourse. And we certainly are leaning heavily in to understand how industry can be adversely impacted by what we could potentially be arbitrary actions, or certainly quick policy changes, by the incoming administration. So it's a very fluid situation, and I've got a couple of slides toward the end here that talk a little bit more about some of the executive orders and secretarial orders that we've seen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Machicki.
I had a follow-up on Senator Von Imhoff's question. So there are so many ways, right, that a new administration could get in the way. So you talked about the dedicated guaranteed property rights through the leasing system, but production techniques are not guaranteed in those leases, right? So not only permitting, but seismic activity, hydraulic fracturing, any chemical activity. I mean, there's a lot of sneakier ways that the new administration could really compromise the economics of a project. Is that right?
Senator Machicki, you're absolutely correct.
Is the department sort of evaluating what the potential is for each of those steps on how it will affect the state of Alaska? Because that may be one way, again, moving forward, if they're going to take some populist actions on trying to stem the production of oil and gas, hydrocarbons. Are there other ways that we could possibly negotiate for production on existing leases as we await the next 2 or 4 years?
And through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes. I think that working with our sister agency at Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, who has the authority over fracking, as you know and as the committee members know, we have 40-plus years of fracking in this state. It's a routine function in the reservoirs on the North Slope, and we have also the most stringent fracking regulations any place in the nation. And, in fact, AOGCC, I believe, updated those as recently as 2015. So we will be looking to understand potential impacts to any kind of sweeping change in those. And I also believe that it's a matter of education, where, you know, fracking in certain basins in other parts of the country or other parts of the world can have certain impacts. Helping the administration and the new agencies understand how things are different in Alaska, both from how we manage them and all the way down to how geologically it may differ from things like shale, for example, then I believe that is helpful in terms of you know, this is an administration that has talked about wanting to listen to the science. And so we being able to provide them with the best available science on Alaska oil and gas operations, I think will be germane to that conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Feige. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, just one more dovetailing off Senator Von Imhoff's question dealing with the permitting. There was a Reuters article a couple days ago about how even though there's the secretarial order and the executive order from the president, that because there's been so many stockpiled, the way they termed it was stockpiled permits, that there still is a lot of work that is and can be done within the NPRA and within other federal leases. Is that correct within the NPRA and ANWR?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, certainly in the western United States where you have shale operations that had large banks of wells drilled yet not completed, and those were wells that economically were just waiting for the right price structure, et cetera. We don't have that same kind of backlog of drilled yet uncompleted wells in Alaska. We're not shale, we're conventional oil. And where NPRA is concerned, we tend to go season to season, or in the case of Greater Moose's Tooth and the Bear's Tooth, which are existing producing units, just like you have with a state-managed unit, you have to submit regular plans of development. At the federal level, those plans typically cover a 5-year period as opposed to just a 1-year period. So you could have a look ahead and potentially have authorizations for work that might take place over a 5-year period. But we certainly do not have a stockpile in Alaska the way that you could have a stockpile of wells waiting for completions and permits to undertake those completions as they do in the West. And federal permits, like state permits, have time frames, typically 3 years. So you could have, for example, in the West, a three-year moving window of wells drilled yet uncompleted that could be sitting on permit approvals.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Please continue.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, the next two slides, actually, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chairman, they go pretty much hand in hand. So I will have Betty quickly click through and then take questions after the second one. The first slide that you see before you, this represents the tracts that were offered in the January 6, 1002 Coastal Plain lease sale. There were 11 tracts that were bid upon, and there were the 9 colored tracts that you can see there on the western side that were actually taken under lease. The light gray tracts that you see on the southeast portion of the 1002 area, those were actually removed from the sale a couple of weeks prior to, after comments received by the BLM during their call for nominations period. There were concerns around caribou calving grounds and other environmental sensitivity down in that acreage, and the BLM chose to remove those tracts from the sale. And so what was bid on was the area you see colored in blue and brown, plus there were bids received for tract 23 and tract 22, but those two were not actually taken under lease. The state of Alaska receives 50% of the proceeds from sales in the Anwar Coastal Plain. The total bid amount was just over $14 million, and the state will bring in 50% of that at just over $7.2 million. And so, Betty, if you could quickly switch to the next slide, you'll see it's the exact same representation, only this time we've overlain the pink area, which represents the area that has been identified by previous geologic work and 2D seismic that was run in the late 80s and early 90s. And that represents the area of highest hydrocarbon potential within the 1002 area. And so you can see that what was taken under lease in those 9 tracts really does, represent the guts of the highest potential acreage within the 1002 area. All of those leases have a 10-year primary term that commenced upon signing, which was about the 15th, I believe, of January.
Thank you. We do have questions. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Feige, this track 29, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that a tract that we have been in dispute with that we claim is state land and we've been in dispute with the federal government? Are we any further along in resolving that, or am I on the wrong track?
No, through the chair, Senator Bishop, you're exactly right. Track 29 is the disputed acreage between the Canning River and the Staines River, and the state has long disputed which is the boundary of the Anwar area. And Track 29 sat, or the acreage of Track 29, sat on appeal to the Interior Board of Land Appeals within Department of Interior for a number of years until about 2 weeks before the announcement of the sale to be held January 6th. And the IBLA ruled against the state and said, nope, they believe in their review that that acreage belongs actually to the federal government. We, the state, still dispute that. We have not exhausted our remedy, and we can still pursue an appeal to court on that acreage. I believe we have a very compelling data set that shows that there was simply a survey error made on the ground back in the, would have been the early 60s. And if you've ever been on the ground in that part of Alaska, it's very difficult to actually know where you are. And so we are going to continue to press that. In advance of the sale itself, in our comments on the call for nominations, we expressed to BLM that the state still believes that that acreage belongs to the state. And so we exercised under ANILCA what is called our 906B. And our 906, we sent a 906B letter. And what that essentially does is it puts the BLM on notice that we believe that is state acreage, and that if they should place that acreage under lease, that our expectation is that any revenues generated by that will be held in an escrow account, because at the time of resolution, the state will be due 90% of those revenues. So it is still very much alive. We have a window of, I believe, 2 years, if I remember correctly, to press the issue with the IBLA, or excuse me, with the IBLA's decision into court. And we're presently contemplating how we go about doing that, and what the right time is, really, in terms of the other litigation that we're involved in presently dealing with the coastal plain.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bishop stole my question, so I'll steal his follow-up. Commissioner, how do we swing 90% of the revenue if we win the appeal on that parcel when we only get 50% of what's in the ANWR leases otherwise? Or, excuse me, 90% if we lose the appeal. Yeah. Win?
Through the chair. Thank you for that, Senator Keel. You've hit on a very important point here. If the state prevails on the fact that what is Track 29 actually belongs to the state, then we would convert that lease to a state lease, and therefore all of the revenue would come to the state. The 90% would apply to any revenue that's collected by the federal government during the period in which we are now, before we actually have resolution on that dispute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I don't know what your timeline looks like. It looks like we're doing okay, Mr. Chairman. Is that?
We are.
Okay. Commissioner Feige, I'm interested in how you would answer this question. When we began the fight for NPRA, I'm sorry, when we began the fight for ANWR, we were not privy to the exciting geology in NPRA. How would you sort of discuss the lack of interest in ANWR at this time? Is it because of sort of the dedication as we move north and west and that exciting geography or geology, or is it and guys, this isn't a party thing, this is just a policy thing on the change of administration. Do you think it was more of a fear of the outcome because the election results that we had very little interest in ANWR, or do you think it's because of the sort of commitment moving north and west this time?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. You know, I think it's a little of all of the above, but I believe there was also another factor at play. So first of all, I know for a fact that companies were being threatened by ENGOs, their families were being threatened, their businesses were being threatened, their offices were being picketed. And so, you know, the campaign against anyone even contemplating participating in an ANWR lease sale, the pressure was pretty intense. Why would you, you know, drag your board of directors, et cetera, and your employees through that kind of a meat grinder? That said, this is a business that is profit-driven, and where opportunity presents itself, we tend to see investment dollars follow. I can't think of anybody in the oil business who I would consider spineless or weak-kneed. These are not risk-averse people. So I think part of what also happened is, yes, you had the uncertainty around the possibility of an incoming Biden administration. That certainly impacts NPRA as well, but I think it was certainly amplified and heightened for the 1002 lease sale area. I believe that what also potentially impacted industry participation was we had ADA step forward, and because of ADA's structure and the fact that they have to make board activities known to the public, they were in a position to announce publicly that they were contemplating participation in the lease sale. And having participated in lease sales myself from the industry side, there's a certain amount of gaming theory that goes into how you participate, how you bid, what tracks you bid on, and it is a check and double check process. And I believe that when ADA made their announcement, and industry knew that a state entity would be participating in the sale with the intent of potentially taking tracks, that it changed industry behavior. No longer did those companies need to go out and expose their company reputation and their boards of directors, et cetera, to the scrutiny and, frankly, to the meat grinding in the press, when they could wait, see what acreage was taken under lease, and then come potentially at a later date and deal with someone like ADA.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner Feige. That was very insightful. So we do have five slides left, and so if members could be considerate with questions until we get to the end, so that we can be respectful of everybody's time. Please proceed.
All right. Wonderful. So moving on to slide 13, and I think we can move through this pretty quickly. I know that the members of the committee received copies of this secretarial order 3395 in the packet. This secretarial order was issued on January 20th by Acting Secretary Scott De La Vega of the Department of Interior. And this is the secretarial order which instituted the 60-day suspension on any authorizations of any kind from the regional level or bureaus or offices within the Department of the Interior. It addresses everything from actions on resource management plans to anything being published in the Federal Register. And for those in the public who may not understand, an action can be signed by the secretary or by a director within a federal agency, but until it is actually published in the Federal Register, it does not take effect. So it's a bit of a you know, a shift between I've got something that's signed, but it's not yet effective until I publish it in the register. And so that tends to put that placeholder. It holds everything in limbo, if you will. So that's the import of the Federal Registry piece. There are to be no issuances of rights of way, leases, conveyances of land of any kind. That certainly has implications for Alaska with listing of public land orders and the attachment of state select lands and the conveyance of title on those lands. It also impacts RS-2477 claims, mining plans of operation. Really, it was the wholesale stop sign for activity within Department of the Interior, unless it was authorized and signed by someone that had either been confirmed or it was in an official acting position. So this was the piece that impacted Project Peregrine in NPRA and got the CODEL, the congressional delegation, engaged with the Biden administration last weekend. And so this order and subsequent restrictions like it could well prohibit exploration activities within the 1002 area or certainly areas in NPRA outside of the existing producing units. All right. And if no questions there, we'll move on to the next slide, which talks about Executive Order 13990. And this executive order was issued by President Biden on the 25th. And this is the order is called Protecting Public Health and the Environment and Restoring Science to Tackle the Climate Crisis. And I think what's important to note in here is that this directs all agencies to immediately review and take action to address any regulation or other actions that were promulgated over the course of the Trump administration that may conflict with the policy directions of the Biden administration. And largely those policy initiatives within the Biden administration, as you know, are focused on climate change and climate crisis. For me, I think where we're going to see the greatest amount of discussion, and this is certainly something that the state is going to be paying extremely close attention to, is this discussion on listening to the science. The question here is, who gets to decide what is the science? And what science is robust enough? The National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, reviews require that all data submitted in the environmental information documents in support of the application must be derived from the best available data, and that scientific data must be meaningful to the question being asked. And when you're talking about scientific and technical data, that data should be robust, repeatable, and peer-reviewed. It is going to be very interesting to see if we're going to apply that bar, if the new administration will apply that bar to robust, repeatable, and peer-reviewed science, because there are a lot of questions that exist around climate science and the implications for or impacts of greenhouse gas. So this, I think, is going to be one of the more robust discussions that we see carry forward in the years ahead. Clearly, the other policy directives here are to improve public health and protect the environment, ensure access to clean air and clean water, limit the exposure to dangerous chemicals and pesticides, and make sure that we're holding polluters accountable. They also point on focus on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and bolstering the resilience to climate change, restoring and expanding national treasures and monuments, and the prioritization of environmental justice. There was another executive order issued today, and while I've not seen that order, I have seen the fact sheet. And that order really addresses the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and the restoration of national treasures, as well as an indefinite pause on new oil and gas leasing on federal lands in the country. It talks about expanding national treasures and monuments and access to outdoor education by what they call 30% by 2030. And you may be aware of that initiative, but that initiative seeks to protect, or conserve is the word they use, 30% of both the land in the country as well as 30% of the water in the country by 2030. And so there will be a large push for conservation initiatives, and certainly in Alaska that could mean large areas offshore tied up or see drilling moratoriums or leasing moratoriums placed on those. This raises questions for the Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Program and the proposed lease sale for Cook Inlet that is out for public comment as we speak. So this executive order also specifies that EPA regulations related to the oil and natural gas sector and any emissions, this would be methane venting and methane emissions, also be addressed with some very specific action to be taken by September of 2021. And this really is the key area that could impact Alaska's existing oil and gas operations, because it's unknown at this time how EPA's review of its regulations are going to affect operations, things like air permits in the state for large oil and gas operations on the North Slope or in Cook Inlet. And so DEC will be fully engaged because they implement the Clean Air Program, or they administer the Clean Air Program for EPA in the state. And so this falls squarely in their domain. And questions on this, or we can go to the next slide, which is also on 13990.
Please continue.
Yeah, great. So on slide 15, this is just more of what was contained in that executive order. It did suspend the Coastal Plain ANWR leasing program, but it has no effect on the existing leases that were issued in January because, again, those were a pre-existing property right. It does place a temporary moratorium on all activities related to the implementation of the oil and gas program. That was defined, it was actually mandated in the Tax Act of 2017, and then the program was subject to a National Environmental Policy Act review, and the record of decision on that was issued in August of 2020. So these three bullet points under the suspension of the ANWR leasing program on the slide really speak to the Biden administration wanting to take a step back, reevaluate the Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program as it was defined in the Tax Act of 2017, and the secretary here is being instructed to conduct a new environmental assessment and issue essentially a new record of decision. So this is hitting the do-over button, if you will. The Attorney General has also been instructed that he can alert the courts that any pending litigation related to this program, that they can request stays of that litigation depending upon the review. Now, there are currently 4 lawsuits in which the state has intervened that are active around the question of the ANWR oil and gas leasing program. So because this sort of heralds this notion of what we call sue and settle, if a case is brought and the existing administration has had a policy change and doesn't necessarily disagree with the points being brought in the suit, they can theoretically step aside and settle. If the state of Alaska has joined the suit, intervened in the suit, and the federal government steps away, we are still there to press the case points in the complaint. And where the 4 suits that have been filed on ANWR are concerned, they all revolve around the sufficiency of the environmental review that went into that August 2020 record of decision. So I think we're going to see a tremendous amount of activity around a new record of decision and around the litigation surrounding the existing oil and gas lease program. So the accounting for benefits of reducing climate pollution, what is concerning here is that they are creating new terms which currently have no definition. Social cost of carbon, social cost of nitrous oxide and methane. At the present time, the full cost of greenhouse gas emissions is unknown. We don't have a metric and we don't have a meter for measuring that. There's a whole lot of assumption that goes into that. So that brings us back to the question of listening to the science and who gets to decide what is science of a sufficient quality to answer some of these questions. Now, the Liberty decision, which came out of, and this would be the Liberty development on the North Slope, it's held by Hillcorp, and it sits on federal acreage. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just a few weeks ago issued a decision that said that BOEM, which is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, they said that they had done an insufficient job of explaining why they dismissed or didn't fully develop the discussion around this total cost or potential damages or impacts globally to greenhouse gas emissions associated with the Liberty development. So you can see there's a nexus here to what we now see in the executive order. And again, this whole discussion of the impacts and how do you measure and then how do you put a monetary value to what those impacts of greenhouse gas emissions are around the globe from a well drilled on the North Slope of Alaska. It's a daunting issue, but I really think it has the potential to, you know, suck the air out of the room, for lack of a better term, as we start to dig into some of these issues. They are going to be establishing a working group to help define these terms, and clearly when we understand what that looks like and if there's a way for the state to be a stakeholder in that or a cooperating agency in that, then we will certainly try to inject ourselves into that process and have a seat at the table. Okay. And then the last 2 slides I really have just included for your own reference. It talks a little bit about what's next and then what it means to delay, you know, what delay can mean coming through federal actions. On slide 16, it talks a little bit about how those policy priorities can be set with the stroke of a pen, but that the change of regulations and the change of records of decision and the change of any process takes more process at the federal level. It's a bit overwhelming at this point in time because we're seeing all of these orders come very fast, and we're still in the process of trying to unpack all of the information that's in them and really digest what they mean to the state and what has direct implications for operations in Alaska. And really and truly, I think in a nutshell, it is the way that any project which requires an EPA authorization, which is going to be any project that needs to go through a National Environmental Policy Act or NEPA review to get an EIS or an EA, is certainly going to become subject to the policies of this administration. Will that EA or EIS come quickly? Will it be slow rolled? Will it be denied based upon some of the new metrics and new science that they want to fold into the process? And then for those areas like Willow and GMT and even the exploration acreage in NPRA and the 1002 of ANWR, will they move quickly on permit authorizations or will they slow roll those permit authorizations to really kind of draw out the timeline in the process? And certainly where developments are concerned, time is money. And so delays impact project economics. And that as well is an area where I think the state is going to have to work very diligently with those federal agencies to continue to impress upon them the importance to the state, the material nature of that throughput to TAP, the royalty impacts to our North Slope communities through the Impact Mitigation Grant Fund, and there is a very real and very different impact from slow rolling federal authorizations, and especially those in NPRA, as it comes to impacting North Slope Borough and those communities. And we will be engaging in conversations with North Slope Borough through the MOU that we have with them, and then seeing what we can do to support them in that discussion and certainly continue to advance the state's interest. And at this point, I know we're running a little close on time, but I'm available for any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Do we have questions? None. Well, thank you, Commissioner Feige. Thank you, Mr. Black. Thank you, Mr. Frank. We very much appreciate the insight, your time here today. We look forward to many more, just sort of scratching the surface today. We really appreciate you being with us. Want to thank all the members of the committee again. I'm very honored and humbled to be here, and I look forward to working with you over the next couple years. With that, it is 4:58 p.m., and this meeting is adjourned. Actually, first, we don't yet have an agenda for next week, but we'll get that to you guys as soon as possible. So 4:58, this meeting is adjourned.